From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It was the last thing George Bush needed as Washington braces for possible war with Iraq. North Korea announcing it has nuclear weapons, shipping Scuds to the Middle East, threatening to bust open sealed nuclear plants, practically daring Washington to react. Northeast Asia is slipping toward a nuclear crisis. In this hour, On Point, another front opens in the axis of evil. How should Washington respond to the threat from Pyongyang? We begin with the view from across the Korean DMZ in Seoul. Many in South Korea blame Washington for inciting North Korea to wag its nukes. Japan is considering whether to expand its military and even publicly discussing possible development of its own nuclear weapons. Joining me now is John Larkin, Seoul correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. Hello and welcome, John Larkin.
Thank you.
John Larkin, what has North Korea so restless and apparently threatening now all of a sudden?
Well, that's the big question, I guess. Basically, this is a cry for attention from North Korea to get the United States to come back to the conference table to talk, because the North Korean economy is in such a is basically a basket case. It needs as much money as it can possibly get to fix it up. The only way it can get that is to get the U.S. And possibly Japan to the table. The problem is that the only card, the only bargaining chip that Pyongyang has that allows it to keep its regime in place is its weapons of mass destruction, and that's the reason for all the confrontation we're seeing now.
But instead of getting to a new bargaining table, fuel supplies, crude oil supplies to North Korea have been cut off. The tensions are rising. What's the fear level in Northeast Asia right now, in South Korea, Japan, even China?
Well, everyone's very concerned. It's got to be said that we're not at the point yet of deep crisis. It takes the North Koreans haven't actually reloaded their reactor yet. They've just threatened to do it. It's only been words. So everything's reversible at the moment, but it's certainly slipping towards some kind of crisis, and it's looking very similar to what happened in 93-94 when military strikes against North Korea were very narrowly averted. So that's a huge concern, especially in Seoul, which is within range of North Korea's artillery batteries on the demilitarized zone, the border between the two Koreas. So everyone's very worried, and there are various and widely divergent interpretations on how to handle this issue, and there's a widening split on this question between Washington and Seoul.
And that coming on the eve of presidential elections in Seoul, where the two candidates have very different approaches. Lay that out for us, if you would, John Larkin.
Well, there are two main candidates. There's the conservative candidate, Mr. Lee Hoi-chung. He's with the Grand National Party. His main opponent is Mr. Noh Moo-hyun. Mr. Noh is very much in favor of engaging North Korea. He believes that the only way to avert war on the Korean Peninsula is to try and build confidence with North Korea, engage them in economic cooperation, and improve diplomatic ties that way. But Mr. Lee thinks that that's naive and foolhardy, because that just gives money to a regime that is a nuclear proliferator, as it recently admitted to being, and ships missiles to the Middle East, as we've seen in recent days.
So how are South Koreans interpreting Washington's response to the new surliness out of North Korea?
Not very well. In fact, as you're probably aware over there, there's a lot of anti-American sentiment here. That's caused, at least on the surface, by the death of the tragic death of two young girls in June who were run over by a U.S. armored vehicle. But really, the underlying reason for this is South Koreans are very much fed up with Washington's attitude toward North Korea. Regardless of the right and wrongs of how to approach North Korea, they believe that Washington is basically running with its hobnailed boots all over the peninsula and sabotaging its efforts to create peace with North Korea. So that's causing a lot of anger. They feel that the military alliance between Seoul and Washington is very much lopsided, and Seoul should have more say in what goes on the peninsula.
So if the presidential election goes to Noh Moo-hyun, are we likely to see a Seoul, South Korea less cooperative with Washington, just as North Korea raises the temperature?
Absolutely. I think Washington must be very, very worried about this. Mr. Noh is an obviously articulate, intelligent man, but he doesn't hold views which the United States, at least privately, would agree with. He even called in the early 1990s, or he signed a petition which called for the exit of U.S. troops in South Korea. So, you know, that's a very sensitive issue here, and really anyone who does that is deemed by South Koreans to be rather left of center. Obviously, if he comes to power, there's going to be some kind of realignment in the relationship with the United States, perhaps some distance put between Seoul and Washington. On the other hand, he may realize that the relationship with Washington is extremely important to South Korea's military security, and make concerted efforts to try and get closer. But at least on the surface, on the eve of the presidential election, as you say, that it's looking quite tense from the perspective of which candidate that Washington would like to see in office.
And John Larkin, a final question: why is it that South Koreans, I guess, are not more apparently upset about what North Korea is doing? They want the friendly approach. Washington is interpreting North Korea's actions as aggressive, as hostile, and seems to want to respond, as you say, with a very tough response. What's the different reading in South Korea, who's right next to North Korea, who would potentially be the first target for an attack, that makes them more tolerant or less upset about North Korea's moves?
Well, I guess the main reason is the fact that they've lived with it for 50 years and more. So they're used to these provocations from North Korea. They've just learned to tolerate it, and they realize, I think, that in a very pragmatic way, that you've just got to get on with your life and make the best of it. And nothing has happened to blow up the peninsula since 1953, so I think there's a sense of complacency set in here. But there's also, I think, a cultural dimension, and I think there's a perhaps an understanding, sometimes even a sympathy, frankly, towards North Korea that's shown here in South Korea. Perhaps that foreigners like myself and people in the United States don't really understand. In the United States and most of the Western world, we look on North Korea as a proliferator, a very dangerous regime, and so we look at it from a very narrow legalistic way. But being Korean, speaking the same language as the North Koreans, and essentially having the same blood, as it were, gives you a rather different perspective. But on the surface, at least publicly, they're very much on the same page. Of course, the two governments. The last thing they want is a split in the alliance, because that helps North Korea.
John Larkin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
John Larkin is Seoul correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. The Bush administration is focusing its attention on Iraq, but should it be more concerned about North Korea and its announced nuclear weapons? Should we be paying as much attention to Kim Jong-il as to Saddam Hussein? Or is North Korea just kicking up dust, just asking for attention? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Williamsburg, Virginia, is Mitchell Reese, Dean of International Affairs at the College of William and Mary. In the mid-90s, he was chief negotiator of the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization, formed to funnel huge energy resources to North Korea in exchange for the North's promise to freeze and dismantle its nuclear weapons program. He was also a special assistant to the National Security Advisor in Washington in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Good evening and welcome, Mitchell Reese.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Mitchell Reese, you know the Korean Peninsula and North Korea very well. You've been deeply involved in negotiations there. What keeps you up at night when you consider where North Korea is headed?
The biggest concern that I have, and I think the biggest concern for policymakers in Washington, is the prospect of a North Korea that has the capability to generate large numbers of nuclear weapons each year. And as we've seen with its ballistic missile program, the wherewithal to distribute those warheads or those nuclear weapons around the world to friendly countries or even to individuals, a few of which would be friends of the United States.
When you say ballistic missile program, as far as I know, the longest-range ballistic missile test North Korea has had only sent missiles over Japan, not as far as Europe or the United States or other continents.
That's right. They launched a three-stage ballistic missile over Honshu Island in 1998. U.S. intelligence.
The main island of Japan.
The main island of Japan. U.S. intelligence thinks that it will have, within a relatively short number of years, the capability to have a range that could reach Alaska or the west coast of the United States. The ballistic missiles that we saw exported to Yemen and to a number of other countries around the world that don't receive as much publicity are shorter-range missiles.
The Scuds, just, 10 or 20 miles?
That's right, Scuds and Nodongs, which are seriously destabilizing to those regions, can be destabilizing to the regions to which they export.
Mitchell Reese, North Korea has announced that it now has nuclear weapons. Do America's intelligence agencies believe that?
Well, if I can just be a little bit more precise and clarify,
please.
What I think the North Koreans said is that they said that they were entitled to have nuclear weapons. I don't think that they ever said that they have them. Now, U.S. intelligence for a number of years has a high degree of certainty that the North Koreans have separated enough plutonium that can be used for one or two nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They're less certain, but I think we have to assume that they have taken that plutonium and actually assembled one or two nuclear weapons. And that's where things stand right now. And the danger with the current crisis is that they could break out of this situation, which has frozen their nuclear capability for the last 6, 7, 8 years, and generate large numbers of nuclear weapons in a relatively short period of time.
How did we come to this pass, Mitchell Reese? The last time we all paid attention, there was a grand bargain made. North Korea would stand down. It would seal the nuclear reactors that were being used for energy production, but also could produce, enriched fuel for nuclear weapons. Those were sealed. Japan, the U.S., perhaps others remind us, agreed to offer crude oil and light water nuclear reactors that were not dangerous. How did we get off that track? What happened?
Well, it's always difficult to divine the motivations of North Korea, but let me try and explain to the audience what the North Koreans have said and what the North Koreans have told me privately as well as in their public announcements.
Mm-hmm.
That they feel that they had a bargain with the United States in 1994 that was going to lead to a new relationship between North Korea and the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
a relationship that would eventually allow the two countries to normalize relations. Economic sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on North Korea would be lifted, there'd be more direct investment, and there would be a more normal relationship between the two countries.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, in the 95-96 period, that was promising and things were going in a good way. Towards the latter end of the decade, the interest on the part of the United States, Japan, and South Korea to engage the North really waned. In part because of North Korean provocations. In September of 96, people may recall a North Korean submarine ran ashore in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
There were other incidents at sea and along the demilitarized zone. For whatever reason, the North Koreans believed the U.S. was not sincere about this grand bargain being actually fulfilled. And so around that time, we now know they started to engage on a secret uranium enrichment program. And so this was a complete violation of the original 1994 deal, as well as at least two or three other international agreements that they had signed up to.
If North Korea wanted normalized relations, why the provocative action along the way? Is North Korea capable, is its leadership capable of getting on a real path to normalization, or is it always going to be this prickly stop-start and even nuclear threat path?
Well, that's a good question. And again, it's very difficult for anyone to understand the motivations of North Korea. A number of people have called it the longest-running intelligence failure in U.S. history. It's a diplomatic black hole. Very difficult to divine what it is they're doing. Many people assume that the North Koreans are extremely insecure because of the U.S. presence in the region, the U.S. being a nuclear power. The U.S. threatened to use nuclear weapons against Korea during the Korean War. So they have a sense of inferiority, a sense of insecurity. All of this was increased by the end of the Cold War, where their key ally, the Soviet Union, disintegrated. All their allies in Eastern Europe, the regimes were toppled.
And suddenly it felt pretty lonely there. Mitchell Reese, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about North Korea, the U.S., and a nuclear relationship slipping out of control. Is it time to crack down on North Korea or to step up diplomacy, to talk tough or make nice? And who's the greater threat here, Saddam or Kim Jong-il? How do you talk to an old adversary that goes nuclear to get your attention? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about North Korea, the United States, and a nuclear relationship slipping out of control at a very bad time. You can join the conversation. How do you talk to an old adversary that goes nuclear or reminds you it's entitled to get your attention? And is the Bush administration capable of keeping Pyongyang in check while it deals with Baghdad? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Mitchell Reese, Dean of International Affairs at the College of William and Mary. He's been was deeply involved in all the trade-offs of energy for North Korean compliance and normalization in the 90s. Those seem to be falling apart around us. We are now joined as well by General Barry McCaffrey, joining us from Alexandria, Virginia. He's professor of national security studies at West Point. He led the 24th Mechanized Infantry Division in the Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, General McCaffrey.
Tom, good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. General McCaffrey, when you look at North Korea and its claims, it's reminding the United States it's entitled to have nuclear weapons, its threat to break open the seals on the nuclear reactors that would produce fuel for more weapons. What's the scope and scale of this threat in your mind as a military man?
Well, I think it's considerable. You know, we walked right up the edge of war in 1994 during the Clinton administration. I remember walking into Secretary Bill Perry, brought in all the worldwide commanders in chief, and essentially we had laid down a marker that said either close down the Yongbyon plant or we'll go get it by air. The response had been that will mean war, and we had essentially said so be it. And so we've been there before. We now probably, although we're not sure, in a situation where there's some number, four or five nuclear weapons up in North Korea, a million-man army, it's almost 22 million people, a nation in arms, probably 20% of the military male-age population under arms, 31% of the GDP, and with a Byzantine, quirky, and unpredictable political system. So, you know, to add in the potential, let's take it out 5-10 years, if they bring the next two reactors online, which are not yet completed, they could be producing 30 nuclear weapons a year. And they've got a considerable missile force, probably some 500 Scud or improved Scud through their new three-stage missile. So it's a huge threat to the Japanese, to the South Koreans, to U.S. Regional military power, and presumably creating some anxiety among the Chinese and the Russians also.
So given all that, does the United States really have a military option with North Korea?
Well, I cannot imagine a more unpalatable set of options currently on the table. I think Secretary Powell, going to the Chinese, started the process of attempting to use multinational diplomacy and leverage to hold the North Koreans in check. I notice we have not taken the food aid off the table. We're saying we want to open the country to the U.N. food inspectors, but we're going to try and keep that flowing to them.
Though the 500,000, I guess, tons of crude oil is off the table. It's not flowing.
Yeah, no, the food aid. That will continue.
Still going.
We suggest if we can get the U.N. inspectors into the huge pieces of the country that are off limit to them. Because the supposition is that the food aid is going to the army, not to the people. You know, probably a number, the professor probably has a better feel for it. As many as a million North Koreans died of starvation or murder in the last 15 years.
I want to jump right back in with Mitchell Reese in just a moment. One more question first. General McCaffrey, we're not military folks here. Are we at risk of having a two-front hot war on the axis of evil here? Might we be engaged with Iraq and North Korea at the same time? Is that conceivable?
Well, I think Secretaries Powell and Rumsfeld will have to make it not conceivable. I mean, it would be a bad option for the United States and our regional allies. It's a bad option in any way to court war with North Korea. I think what you'll see them do is try and hold Korea in abeyance for 12 to 18 months during the acute stage of the Iraq crisis, and having resolved that, then come back to the table and try and devise some strategy to bring these people out of their starvation and misery and back into the international community. The least acceptable option is to go to war with North Korea. You know, who knows? A million casualties, tremendous civilian refugee concerns, it would be a disaster.
And yet, as you say, in 1994, not long ago, we were close to that.
Yeah. Well, I think before we're done with this, we'll create the conditions under which the North Koreans won't have weaponized nuclear weapons deliverable by missile. You know, they're working on a missile right now. In the next, I'd say, decade or less, I'll have a missile that can reach the west coast of the United States.
You're saying we'll create those conditions. What do you mean by that?
Well, one way or the other, we won't allow North Korea, take it out 5 to 10 years, to have several hundred nuclear weapons and the missile systems to deliver them. Now, the preferred option would be diplomatic and economic leverage. But I think the backdrop of military coercive power will also be part of the tool set.
Mitchell Reese, how can Washington be most effective in pulling North Korea back from this kind of renewed aggressive noises and into a conversation? And has the Bush administration been following a path that makes that likely or most likely?
Well, as the general said, the administration from the very beginning has said they want a diplomatic solution to this, and we've been working with our allies and friends in the region very closely, very carefully, to try and have them put pressure on North Korea. We saw a few days ago the leaders of Russia and China issue a joint statement criticizing the North Korean regime. Certainly should have come as a surprise to Pyongyang and not a welcome one on their part. So I think the administration is hoping that we can do this by proxy, by South Koreans, Japanese, Chinese, and Russians, to persuade the North Koreans to return to the status quo ante, where they give up their enriched uranium program and freeze their plutonium program.
The Wall Street Journal last week is characterizing the Bush administration as less willing to talk with Pyongyang than the Clinton administration had been. Is that fair?
Well, yes and no. Let's go back a little ways. And starting in June of 2001, the Bush administration said that they were willing to talk with the North Koreans anytime, anywhere, with no preconditions. And for almost a year, the North Koreans stiffed the United States on that. And so here was a U.S. that was willing to sit down and talk with them, and it wasn't until the spring of this year when talks started to revive. Assistant Secretary of State Jim Kelly was set to go out to North Korea in early June, and there was an incident where a North Korean gunboat sunk a South Korean vessel. Obviously, the meeting didn't take place. So it's not quite accurate to say that this administration has not been willing to talk to North Korea. The larger issue is, what are we going to discuss when we sit down with them? And I think that's a much more problematic issue, and one, as the general suggested, we're going to have to come to grips with if we want to get a handle on this crisis.
Well, John Larkin with the Far Eastern Economic Review at the top of the hour said from Seoul that what North Korea really wants is American attention. And we have, of course, read over the years they would like American cash, I guess, in return for a more amiable kind of conversation about even reunification with the South.
Well, usually the cliche is that whatever North Korea does is a desperate cry for attention, not just a cry for attention. And I'm not persuaded. As I suggested earlier, I'm not sure that it's easy to categorize North Korea's motivations in a single way. I think that what they're doing now satisfies a number of constituencies in the North, the hardliners that want to move to increase their nuclear weapons capability, as well as perhaps their softliners or their foreign ministry diplomats that want to engage with the outside world and see this as a way of getting our attention. Right now, their actions satisfy both of those schools of thought in the North. They don't have to decide which path to go down right now.
Listeners, you can join the conversation. If North Korea wants to be paid off to settle down, should we pay up, or should we hang tough, even fight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Brian's on the line. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if you guys could compare and contrast the threat that Iraq poses versus that of North Korea, and then I guess also upcoming threats, because it seems to me the system that you've described is going to lead to more and more countries gaining weapons of mass destruction. There's absolutely no incentive not to, and every incentive to gain these weapons. And it seems to me you need to do something about that international system. But I'm wondering also about something that would be a lot more proactive. We talk about being the world's leader. Well, it seems to me negotiating with every regime that has or is trying to gain weapons of mass destruction is a very weak position. why not something like working now for international controls on nuclear materials so that nobody can have access, or working toward economic stability? You know, if you look at the money that we just put into bombing Afghanistan, that we are mobilizing toward a likely war with Iraq when the CIA says there's no threat, what could you do with those couple of billion dollars towards some kind of international controls that lead us to something that's a lot more stable and sustainable?
Brian, you paint a big picture. Hang around and let's hear the responses. First of all, General McCaffrey, if you would, Brian's asking for a threat comparison between Iraq and North Korea.
Yeah, well, I sometimes think this is, you know, the comparative threat analysis is a useless way to go about policy. Both of them are concerns. Iran's a concern. I mean, the Iraqis in the short run, of course, are parked near a vital U.S. national interest, which is easy access to Persian Gulf oil supplies. We have some allies who are at risk, the Kuwaitis, the Saudis, and others. And I think there's been a widespread consensus in the part, certainly the policymakers and both the legislative branch and the administration, that we're going to have to deal with the WND threat. So we should expect that will proceed apace. And it probably, in my judgment, will involve the use of military force by a coalition of the willing in the coming 180 days. So that's
on
against Iraq. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to happen. Now,
do you think that that's the fair and correct priority over North Korea?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have I think the Iraqis are on the verge, who knows, a year to 5 years from having multiple nuclear weapons. They've got a sizable chemical and biowarfare threat. They've got an anemic ability to deliver these weapons, fortunately. But they've now got $3 billion a year in oil money flowing into the country. So left to their own devices within some period of time, let's say 5 years, the problem will be, if not unmanageable, have consequences that may pose disastrous threat risks to Europeans and us and the region. So I think that's sort of a summation, in my view, of the Iraq.
On the Iraq side. Now, on North Korea side, they also sit right on top of what you could see as important resources for the United States, the economies and the allies in South Korea and Japan, and their weapons development seems to be well ahead of Iraq's.
Yeah, no question. Well, I think they are. They're a threat to the Japanese, who are a vital aspect of our international economic cooperation sphere, and there's no question the South Koreans merit our, you know, our solidarity for a variety of reasons, among which are history. So there's no question these people are a threat, and in some ways a more bizarre threat, because we, you know, we think they're capable of unpredictable, irrational behavior. I'm not sure I'd ever try, and I noticed that one of the questioners wanted to talk about the symmetry of logic between us and the North Koreans. I don't think it's there. We'd make a mistake, I think, to search for, you know, mirror image responses. So they're both threats. The Iranians are a threat. But now the strategic response, it seems to me, they ought to be quite different with all three of those nations.
Mitchell Reese, you hear in Brian's question also this sense that the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction is so easy and potentially so widespread that fighting one fire after another, each in its own way, seems overwhelming. Is there not a more effective, systematic way of diminishing the environment for proliferation of these weapons?
Well, since the beginning of the nuclear age, the United States has been the world's leader in trying to devise systems, institutions, arrangements, regimes to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. We have the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, which has inspectors, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which has over 160 members, and we have systems of export controls that we apply unilaterally as well as multilaterally. The problem with all these efforts, with all these regimes, is that they're not self-enforcing. Countries cheat. Countries do things covertly. And countries can also acquire chemical, nuclear weapons, biological weapons by themselves. They can build them. The science isn't a mystery anymore. So there are limitations to the regimes, and what we're seeing now in the case of Iraq and North Korea and Iran are some of the prime examples of where the regime has failed. And now we have to figure out another way to address these problems.
General McCaffrey, you're the military man. You know how hard it would be to deal with these on one at a time, and especially as you've painted North Korea. from a military perspective, would you like to see international regimes of control somehow stepped up? Are we lagging? Why are things getting out of control?
Well, I think your question is quite on, and Mitchell Reese was exactly correct. Not only do we lack conceptual architecture now to deal with this question, I was a nuclear arms negotiator with Steve Hadley during Bush 90 in the early 90s, and there was a quite a different sort of notion as to what we were up to. There was an enemy. There was a massive confrontation that had to come to a halt. And now we lack the intellectual tools to think through this, given the old world treaties. We're going to have to start it over again. How do we get the Russians, the Chinese, us, and the Europeans, the permanent nuclear powers, to see a common threat, not among ourselves, but from continued proliferation? So we've got some work to do. There's a vacuum of thought here on dealing with this this question, and military action is clearly the last of all your options.
So you're saying, in spite of the United States' long record of leadership in this area, right now we've kind of run out of the Cold War model and haven't found another one that really effectively replaces it?
Well, yeah. Well, except for Korea, interestingly enough, I thought Dr. Bill Perry and Dr. Ash Carter at Harvard had done a remarkable job in putting together the 94 agreed framework, so we actually saw a way ahead with these people. But now it appears to be evaporating right in front of our eyes, and we've, you know, their policy, it seems to me, has run off its rails, and we lack a way ahead. We're going to have to devise one, or we risk being in a situation where the whole notion of preemptive employment of military power against North Korean nuclear weapons and missiles is a real possibility in the coming 5 years.
Tom, let me jump
Mitchell
in
Reese,
and just say that there are three additional factors now that weren't present certainly 10 years ago, maybe not even 5 years ago, and that is the threat from terrorism. Mm-hmm. Clearly after 9/11, that's obvious. What's a little bit less obvious is increasing transnational cooperation among a number of these rogues, and we've seen it between North Korea and Pakistan, where North Korea would export its ballistic missiles, and in return, the Pakistanis would export their uranium enrichment technology. That is taking place, and it's increasing among a variety of rogue countries. And the third new element is the enormous reservoir of nuclear material and nuclear expertise that resides in the former Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And that wonderful target, we know, has been attractive to a number of countries, a number of terrorists that have tried to purchase, beg, borrow, or steal nuclear material, or to try and persuade the scientists from the former Soviet Union to come to their country and help them build their own program.
Mitchell Reese, stand by. We're raising some really interesting questions here. I want to come back to how we can build a larger framework, especially with the threat of North Korea sitting right in front of us. Listeners, we're talking about North Korea, the U.S., and a nuclear relationship slipping out of control. Does the Bush administration have too many fires burning here at once, and why? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about North Korea and the United States and a nuclear relationship slipping out of control at a very bad time. My guests tonight are Mitchell Reese. He's Dean of International Affairs at the College of William & Mary. He was chief negotiator for the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization from 1995 to 1999. They were the organization that led the effort to trade North Koreans' new energy supplies and resources in return for North Korea not going down the nuclear path. That is now off the rails. We're also joined by General Barry McCaffrey tonight, professor of national security studies at West Point. You can join us as well. If South Koreans trust Pyongyang, its ultimate good intentions, should Washington trust them too? And how should Washington handle a nuclear-armed loose cannon in striking distance of allies and maybe one day of the west coast of this country? If North Korea is nuclear-armed, is Japan justified in going nuclear too? And who else? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Barry McCaffrey, just before the break, Mitchell Reese was outlining the elements that have led to a new kind of proliferation, that is, the rise of terrorism, the new kind of cooperation between new states with new weapons of mass destruction, the Soviet nuclear assets that are on the market. But we're looking for the model for getting our hands around this without having to take them on militarily, certainly one at a time, which sounds awful. You said the North Korean example of the 90s offers an example of how this might work, but it doesn't appear now to have worked all that well.
No, I think you're right. And by the way, let me, if I may, add to Mitch Reese's sort of sequence there, one other factor I think it's new. Our department up at West Point, Russ Howard and Reed Sawyer, just put out a reasonably good effort, Terrorism and Counterterrorism. We talk about the convergence of international crime, terrorism, and drugs. In the old days, extortion, bank robbery, kidnapping, or ideological supporters from afar were adequate to fund political insurgencies. But what we're now seeing is a sort of a convergence of these factors in which you end up with terrorist organizations with hundreds of millions of dollars. At that point, the whole notion of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction becomes much more feasible. I mean, if you get into the former Soviet Union with a couple hundred million dollars,
there's a lot for sale.
Oh my gosh, the corruption is unbelievable. The, you know, the discipline in the armed forces has unraveled in many cases.
But we tried to use a lot of novel carrots in the case of North Korea. Why didn't that work? We were willing to put in cash, willing to put in new nuclear reactors, willing to put in 500,000 tons of crude oil a year. That's a lot, plus all the food you mentioned. Why couldn't that work?
Well, I think there are two factors. One is the irrational nature of the decision-making process. It's a closed circle. It's a lethal state that literally has murdered hundreds of thousands of its own citizens. And it's a state that exists in and it believes itself to exist in a state of war, not just with the Americans either, but with the Japanese as a continued threat to historical enmity there. I think the other factor has been that, look, you know, one of the problems is nuclear weapons work. If they attained 300 or 400 or 500 nuclear weapons and the missile systems to deliver them, their influence would be unbelievable against vulnerable allies, to include the Chinese, which is one of my few reasons for optimism dealing with this question, is that I can't imagine the Chinese are going to welcome a nuclear-armed Korea, for that matter, some would argue, a unified Korean peninsula.
Even that, Mitchell Reese, take us into that. General McCaffrey raises a couple of prospects there. One, that the Chinese, like the United States, will not be able to accept the notion of a nuclear-armed North Korea. But the second, that they won't want even a unified Korean peninsula, which brings us back around to the South Koreans' attitude that the U.S. has been bristling too much toward the North, that we should be more trusting, more welcoming. Pick that apart for us.
Okay. First of all, I've put to my Chinese friends the fact that the United States took care of three proliferation problems in that region. We've taken care of Japan, we've taken care of South Korea, and we've taken care of Taiwan. What we're asking them to do is to take care of a single country for us,
North Korea.
And I'm not sure that they are willing to expend the capital, expend the energy in order to do that.
They're willing to have Beijing within missile range of Pyongyang, of North Korea?
I don't think that they feel that they're going to be a target of a North Korean regime armed with nuclear weapons. Now, in terms of the South Koreans, we heard from John Larkin earlier that he was concerned that the next president might put some distance between Seoul and Washington. And he talked about the relatively benign view, or certainly the more benign view that South Koreans have of the North Korean threat. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. But I think any new South Korean president is going to realize that it's absolutely essential, not only for security reasons, but for economic reasons, that the U.S. maintain a robust presence in the region. Economic growth in South Korea depends on stability. Foreign direct investment is an enormously important source of capital for the South Koreans. That will dry up in a heartbeat if there's a crisis, and we've seen those capital flows ebb and flow depending on what's happening on the peninsula. So stability is essential for all sorts of aspects of South Korea, not just the security aspect. And I think the new president is going to realize that very quickly, whomever that might be.
If China's not willing to step up and help stop North Korea's nuclear weapons development, and it's not clear how the United States is going to do that, and South Korea certainly won't do it single-handedly, do you believe, Mitchell Reese, that Japan it would be justified in in breaking a vast taboo and itself developing nuclear weapons?
No, I don't, for a variety of reasons. Justified is a sort of interesting word.
It is.
There are legal impediments to Japan doing that. Domestically, you've got their constitution, which would argue against it. Internationally, they've made pledges, the same pledges North Korea has made, not to acquire nuclear weapons. Now, that could all change, but I think that as long as they feel that they are defended by the U.S. and are covered by the U.S. nuclear umbrella, that there will be no need for them to actually acquire their own nuclear weapons. So one way to look at the whole North Korea problem, it's really a challenge for the United States in managing our allies. We have to make sure that our alliances in the region with South Korea and Japan remain secure, remain strong. And clearly they're undergoing enormous stress right now as North Korea is ratcheting up the tension in the region.
Bach is on the line. Welcome, Bach. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a question, I guess.
All right.
What do you gentlemen think of an, the atom is here. It's not going to go anywhere. The science is there. If you can stop North Korea now, maybe for another decade, I mean, you don't know how long that's going to last. So my idea is, and I guess I would like to hear your opinion on this, is how about creating a global body that would actually bring nuclear energy to third world countries seeking efficient power supplies in a controlled manner, similar to a franchise business model.
So you're saying give everybody nuclear power, but not nuclear weapons. Bach, thanks for your call. Mitchell Reese, isn't that in effect what you tried to do?
Well, that was really the impulse behind the whole nuclear deal in 1994. But going back decades, President Eisenhower offered this nuclear bargain to the world in 1953 in an Adams for Peace speech before the United Nations. So there's been this nuclear bargain out there that we'll share our technology for peaceful purposes as long as people pledge not to acquire nuclear weapons.
But clearly here, that's not all people want, particularly Pyongyang and North Korea. Barry McCaffrey, putting on your military hat again for a moment, as a general, does the situation in North Korea make you less ready and willing to go into Iraq, or is it inconsequential?
Well, if you'd permit me, Tom, backtrack one
yes.
one notion, though. I don't think we ought to kid ourselves that nuclear technology is necessarily a cheap source of energy for developing nations.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranians, the Iraqis, are developing nuclear power strictly to develop nuclear weapons. I mean, some of these
so
reactors...
So the rest is eyewash in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why would the Iranians build a giant underground nuclear reactor facility, which we're now watching on commercial satellites,
mm-hmm.
When they're awash in cheaper energy sources. So
that puts us back on the proliferation thing. We've just got a minute left. How about this issue? Does it put a drag on U.S. military readiness or eagerness, or call it what you will, to go to war with Iraq, that North Korea is sitting there?
Well, we ought to be not very eager to go to war with anyone, to include Iraq, but if required, we'll probably use 250,000 out of 1.4 million men and women of the armed forces to take down the Iraqis in probably a 90-day campaign. Militarily, this is not a significant issue. What is a significant issue is the politics of the region and the loss of human life on both sides, to include the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm.
That's the issue, not whether we can do both of them. We can hold the North Koreans at bay and also work against the Iraqi threat.
General Barry McCaffrey, it's been illuminating to have you on tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Right, Tom. Good to be with you.
Barry McCaffrey is Professor of National Security Studies at West Point. And Mitchell Reese, it's been terrific. Thank you very much for coming on tonight.
My pleasure.
Mitchell Reese is Dean of International Affairs at the College of William and Mary. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the new leader of the Boston Archdiocese addresses the clergy sexual abuse scandal. This is On Point. Yesterday, Bishop Richard Lennon stood at the pulpit of the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston and delivered his first sermon as head of the embattled archdiocese. It was the first Sunday in nearly 19 years that priests in Boston did not insert the name Bernard in the blessings of their mass celebrations. Bishop Lennon was named by the Vatican to temporarily lead the Archdiocese after Cardinal Law's resignation last week. On Sunday, he spoke to the clergy sexual abuse crisis that has shadowed the Church for the past year. Here are excerpts of the bishop's sermon.
We have heard many people and many groups come forward with ideas for how to go forward in addressing the issues. We need to hear what is being said by those who love the church. But even more importantly, we need to hear the Word of God. Look at our first reading today, the reading from the prophet Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring glad tidings to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners, to announce a year of favor with the Lord. The crisis that we have been living through now certainly is reflected in that reading. For how many are brokenhearted? How many are captives of the crimes and the sins of sexual abuse against minors? How many have had their freedom curtailed because of injustices? Indeed, all of the words of Isaiah are applicable in our present moment. And yet those words are an invitation to each one of us who have been anointed with the Spirit. They are an invitation to each one of us as we are rooted in our relationship with the Lord to step forward and to become instruments of God's peace, of God's healing, of God's reconciliation and forgiveness. The church calls this Rejoice Sunday. I am sure that for many of us, rejoicing is very hard. And yet, when we live the mystery of the faith, we realize that the rejoicing is not in ourselves. The rejoicing is that there is a God who loves us, a God who cares for us, a God who wants the community of mankind to be all he has intended it to be. Yes, we rejoice in the Lord. And with that rejoice, that awareness, God willing, not only can things change, but things can improve.
Bishop Richard Lennon, the temporary head of Boston's Catholic Archdiocese, preaching yesterday in his first Sunday Mass since taking over for Cardinal Bernard Law, who resigned last week. On Point is produced by Vigna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...